This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Once upon a time, what Americans knew about themselves came from family and friends, legends, and literature. Then came the pollster. Never mind Davy Crockett and Honest Abe and Betsy Ross. Now we had public opinion polls to introduce us to the average American. The public ate it up. First in the 1920s to learn the basics of life in Middletown America, what we ate and earned and longed for. Then with Gallup polls and the Kinsey Report, why we voted the way we did, and the innermost details of even our sex lives. Today, there seems to be a new poll every 5 seconds. They teach us and they define us. Up next on Point, the poll-driven nation and our understanding of ourselves. We will check in a few minutes with the editor-in-chief of the Gallup poll for the latest on what Americans are thinking and up to right now. But first, joining me from New Haven, Connecticut, is Sarah Igo, assistant professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and author of The Averaged American: Surveys, Citizens, and the Making of a Mass Public. Sarah Igo, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you. I'm glad to join you.
Also with us today from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Jack, thanks for being here.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Professor Igo.
Sarah Igo, take us into your research and your thesis here. You remind us that there was a time when, of course, there were no polls and Americans did not understand themselves by the outcome of polls. Let's go there first. Before there were public opinion polls that defined sectors of society who thought this and that, or the average American, how did Americans understand who they were?
That's a great question. I think there certainly were ways that Americans learned to think about their communities and norms and attitudes. Those usually, I think, came from their communities, their local communities, their families, possibly their religious communities. But one thing that is quite remarkable, as you point out, is that these survey results, poll results, social statistics that we live with today are a relatively new feature of our political and cultural life. They really did not come into public consciousness anyway until the post-World War I era. So before that, people gathered information from local sources, I would say, local communities, and not certainly from quantitative data publicized through the mass media.
So we're imagining friends and family and communities, what the preacher said from the pulpit, but also maybe national legends and figures that came down from history as kind of defining. Remind us how polls got started. Who decided we should take a poll? How did it unfold?
Sure. It's a really interesting history. There were many straw polls conducted in the 19th century, actually beginning about 1820, 1824, when newspapers and citizens conducted their own rather unscientific, in our sense anyway, polls. They on street cars, on trains, on street corners to try to gauge political opinion, mostly about electoral candidates. Mm-hmm. And these were strictly partisan polls. These were polls that were intended to sway people's votes and wouldn't be printed unless they came out as editors of those partisan
right.
newspapers hoped they would.
Right.
There were lots of other kinds of surveys, not polls so much as social surveys that were also conducted in the 19th century, usually by social reformers, sometimes by state bureaucrats, to try to solve social problems. They would count, for instance, the numbers of working girls in Boston, a famous study that was conducted in the late 19th century, or the numbers of black migrants to the north. But these were really surveys that were designed for elites, for small communities of consumers.
Small communities to read, and also, as you write in the book, very often focused on problems, what they defined
That's
as
right.
degenerates, delinquents, defectives, numerical analysis of suicide, prostitution, drunkenness, vagrancy, madness, crime, not the
That's
average
right.
American.
No, no. So what you see that's quite revolutionary, I think, in the 20th century is a turn to new kinds of social objects by really entrepreneurial surveyors. And those were things like normal attitudes, typical communities, average Americans. And in conjunction with a mass media that was eager for this kind of information and eager to publicize it, you see social data playing a completely new role in American life.
You remind us how those are all loaded terms, however, sort of created in part by the statistical pollsters. The taproot of that big vein going to Muncie, Indiana, and an experiment that turned the whole country's head there. Remind us about that.
Sure. Well, the Middletown studies, there were a couple of them, were conducted by Helen and Robert Lind in the mid-1920s. The first study came out in 1929, and it purported to be a study of a representative, actually not a typical, but a representative American community.
Mm-hmm.
The Linds went into this community and lived amongst their subjects and collected data on things that we might not think would be very interesting to a consuming public.
Like?
All kinds of details about how many people had washing machines, what the sizes of their backyards were, how many people believed in hell, and so forth. And they compiled all this data and published it. And to their surprise, many people's surprise, it became a kind of social scientific bestseller in 1929. And for many people, and the media certainly participated in this, it was the very definition of a kind of iconic American way of life and of typical Americans.
And what's your explanation for that huge appetite that rushed out to meet it from the rest of the country? Why did that become a bestseller, the size of backyards and the number of washing machines per capita?
Well, I think this was really a confluence of a number of things. One, the rising authority of social science and social scientific instruments in American life. The perceived waning power of local conventional mores, religious guidelines to guide people. Certainly the work of entrepreneurial surveyors, as I mentioned before, and also a mass media which really made these kinds of facts and figures into human interest stories. But there's something deeper there, too, I think, and that is a demand in the public at large, at least in some part, for neat stories, simple stories maybe, about what connected Americans together, what bound them together in an era of mass immigration, rapid industrialization and urbanization. These numbers supplanted maybe older ways of understanding who Americans were, what they wanted, and what they believed.
Jack Beattie, what's your sense of the appetite that rushed out to meet these polls almost from the very beginning, first in Middletown and then the Gallup poll, then the famous Kinsey reports? This country ate these up. What's your sense of why?
Well, I think you really bring out a lot of the reasons just so cogently, Sarah. The authority of numbers, for one thing. I mean, this is a democracy, and the belief in numbers as having sort of a normative authority. You're not just showing something, you're preaching something when you say 60% of Americans believe. Lord Bryce, in his book on America, thought that this fascination with numbers induced a kind of fatalism in Americans. They felt, my gosh, if 80% think this, who am I to think otherwise? And I think that in the dispersed communities of the 20th century, as you point out, Sarah, people found imagined communities in these statistical artifacts. You could say, well, I fit here and I fit there in this sort of abstract community because the real one had gone. And if the numbers were there, it made you feel, well, powerful.
Sarah, you say, though, that the real one had gone. You say, you're right, that the notion that there was a time when everybody fit a kind of stereotypical Norman Rockwell of America was always an illusion. I even read you describing polls as sort of reinvigorating that illusion for a while out of Muncie.
Yes. No, I think that's true. I think the invention of some of these techniques and the publicity attending them in the middle part of the 20th century really was created a kind of imagined, again, iconic or typical Americanness in a time when people believed that that was on the wane. And I think that's one reason that they gained so much attention and so much controversy. I mean, it should be said, Jack just mentioned Bryce, that there was perhaps a kind of fatalism to believing in these numbers. But boy, to the people who first experienced either being a subject in these kinds of surveys or who were the first consumers of them, they argued with and debated with statistical data and often were quite skeptical, didn't believe it, especially when it didn't square with their own sense of their of the political and social landscape. So this kind of statistical information was deeply unsettling. I think it was a real sea change in how Americans understood who their communities were and what the national public was.
What kind of data provoked the most resistance?
Well, surprisingly enough, you might think that something like the Kinsey reports, which certainly did burst onto the scene in 1948 and 1953 and really topple many people's ideas of what conventional sexuality in the United States was. That sex survey was probably one of the most controversial social scientific events of the 20th century. But even things that we now don't take to be particularly worrisome, that is, that you would share, divulge your political opinions with a stranger on a doorstep, that was also a new experience and a deeply controversial one for many Americans. The idea that someone could even ask those questions and that someone else could compile the answers and then publicize them was not taken lightly.
Sarah Igoe quotes an historian in the saying of the 1930s, the United States had better statistics on its pigs than on its unemployed people, just to name one category. But within a few years, the pollsters were all over the place. They began, she quotes, from Middletown, Robert Lind and Helen Merrill Lind in 1929, saying, "How is one to set about the investigation of anything as multifarious as the gross total thing that is Schenectady, Akron, Dallas, or Keokuk? And indeed, how's one to set about that?" In a moment, we'll hear from the Gallup poll. But Sarah, first to this idea of a mass public having been created by polls. What is it? How do polls make it?
Well, I think the overlapping of new survey technologies that, again, got a very wide audience in the 1920s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and deep concerns about the Americanness of American culture, about what bound people together, I think the overlapping of those two phenomena really did lead statistics to create, in a rather remarkable way, a sense of a national public, a public that was made out of aggregated answers to surveys by anonymous respondents that then Americans could look to as a reflection of themselves.
Was it realistic, and what was the effect of a national public being conceived?
The question about whether it was realistic or accurate is a really interesting one. If you start to look, as I did in this book, into the construction of surveys like the Middletown studies, the Gallup and Roper polls, the Kinsey reports, you see that they were made up of very quirky individual decisions by individual researchers.
For starters, just to go to Muncie, Indiana, Muncie, instead of anywhere else they might have gone, urban or rural, different culture, different region.
That's right. Muncie was an anomaly in many ways in the United States in the 1920s. It had very low numbers of immigrants, for example, and it had, the Lynns believed anyway, a lower than average black population. And those were actually among the reasons they chose it. So they were already imagining a kind of normal or typical America before they even set out on their research. And of course, then the results only furthered the idea that what was normal or average about America was a kind of heartland white native population. And you see this a time and time again in mid-century surveys, that the presuppositions about what was typical and average, of course, influenced the surveyors themselves. So they weren't starting from a blank slate in any sense of the word. They were really beginning with already imagined ideas about normality and typicality.
Jack Beattie, what do you make of the national public that grew up out of all this polling? Do you accept it as a true reflection or insight into what we are? Numbers don't lie, they say?
but people
but
do with numbers. You know, there was a report on Fox News a while ago, and they cited a poll that was damaging to President Bush, and the commentator said, "Now that's the views of 7,000 people, right?" and Sarah cites a headline in here about the Kinsey report: sexual behavior in 7,789 women. In other words, I'm not in that survey. It can't represent me. And I think people, you know, resist that. And yet at the same time, there can be no doubt that there seems to be a correlation of opinion polls with socioeconomic data, with demographic data. But it's so easily misused. And I think one striking example is the values voters idea before the 2004 election confirmed that that working class voters, white working class voters, voted on values, and they voted for Republicans because of values. And this fit the narrative of Tom Frank, who wrote "What's the Matter with Kansas?" Mm-hmm. What was the matter with Kansas? Working class voters voting against their economic interest, voting for values for Republicans. In fact, as Larry Bartels of Princeton discovered, it was all the data, the real opinion data, didn't bear that out at all. It turns out that less affluent voters attach much less weight to social and moral issues than they did to economic issues, and that the values voters, so far as you could tell, were more affluent. And
yet those polls framed our whole understanding, at least in the immediate aftermath of that
election. People started putting on scapulars and medals and so on, politicians and so on. And then the other view was, of course, that the Democrats were losing these white working class voters on this thing. He found that in between the elections of 1952 and 2004, the Democrats had lost exactly 1 point. Among white working class voters in the North. Among Southern whites, they lost 20 points, but 1 point in 14 elections.
Lost a lot of elections, though, in that time. I want to bring in a voice right from the heart of this polling community. Sarah, Jack, stand by. Frank Newport joins us. He's editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll, the nation's longest-running monitor of public opinion. He's author of Polling Matters, Why Leaders Must Listen to the Wisdom of the People. Frank Newport, thanks very much for being with us.
It's my pleasure to be with you.
The story of your organization, Gallup, is right in the middle of the story that Sarah Igoe tells. In between the Middletown survey and the Kinsey report, there's Gallup being born. You've been at it for decades now. How do you think, first of all, Frank, about your long-term effect on the country's understanding of itself? Do you make it more insightful, more accurate, more honest, or not?
Well, those are complex questions. Obviously, your guest, Sarah, there has written an entire book dealing with these issues. But yes, in general, I'm a scientist at heart, a social scientist. And I do believe that if we use objective techniques to try to understand public opinion, American attitudes, we're better off than making guesses and hypotheses or just using man on the street type methodologies. So yes, I think, A, we do understand ourselves better. And most importantly, following the dream of George Gallup and my own personal views, we are allowing public opinion to be used to make policy decisions by our elected representatives in a better way that might have been possible without polling, and I think that's critical.
The polling goes on and on. It never stops. Give us a snapshot, if you'd be good enough, Frank, of some of your most recent polls, just to get in our minds this very familiar rhythm now of how polls are done, the results are put together, we hear them and come to sense ourselves. Take us on a little tour around the block. What are you learning lately from your Gallup polls?
Well, the most frequently asked question in Gallup history, and even up to this point, is presidential job approval, a question that George Gallup pioneered way back in Franklin Roosevelt's days. It's been refined a little since then. But basically, just a up or down on the way the president's handling his job. But we've asked that thousands of times and continually ask it now about George Bush, and that's probably become, along with the Dow Jones average, one of the most frequently referred to statistics we have in American public life. So that's a key of what we do. In this environment today, there are two major streams of polling we're asking about. One is Iraq, since that's the number one problem facing the nation, based on our polling. We and other pollsters probe that. On the other hand, we're now just 11 months away from the first vote of the 2008 presidential election. there's tremendous interest in this election, so we're avidly out there already probing Americans' minds about what they might want and how they're viewing the potential candidates.
Now, we've seen
I'm very interested in religion. Spent a lot of time asking Americans about religion. And, of course, we just ask Americans, are you going to be more interested this Sunday in the game itself when the Super Bowl comes on or the commercials?
And what's the answer to that one, Frank?
Well, the answer is 2-1 the game. But these are game watchers. We had a third of people who say they are going to watch the Super Bowl saying they're actually more interested in the commercials. And when you look at women, it's about 50-50.
And what about religion? What's your latest finding there?
Well, religion's fascinating. I think it's the most fascinating aspect of human social behavior that we could, you know, we could spend hours on that. One of the things, of course, that's most potent about religion these days is its high correlation with political affiliation and behavior in this country. Among white Americans, one's church attendance is one of the best predictors we have about whether or not they're going to vote Republican. The more you go to church, the more you are Republican, which has a lot of fascinating interplay with our understanding of the Islam religion. You know, people who feel intensely about that religion attempt to do something about it politically. In this country, people who feel intensely about their religion want to do something about it in the political arena. A lot of parallels there.
All right, Sarah Igo, you're listening to this exchange, and it's a very familiar exchange. Frank Newport's been good enough to join us any number of times, and as soon as he begins to lay out the treasures of his statistical findings, we're all ears. It has this feeling of a special authority. Now we're seeing ourselves, you know, in the light of science and statistics. What do you make of this exchange? Is this revealing the nation to ourselves, or are we in some kind of, you know, dance that's become familiar but less than satisfactory? How do you hear it, Sarah?
Well, I would say, first of all, that there is a vast difference between the kind of survey techniques being used at the Gallup poll, say, today than in the 1930s and 40s, when they were much more rudimentary and much more problematic in a number of ways. Nevertheless, I think polls, of course, still direct much of our political discourse and our political life, and that's not always good and it's not always bad. I think the example that that Jack brought up earlier of the 2004 election is a really interesting one. Unlike some prior polls that were shown to be dramatically incorrect, like the Literary Digest straw poll of 1936, the one that actually gave Gallup his start, in a sense, by challenging it, or the big defeat that the pollsters faced in 1948 in claiming that Dewey would defeat Truman. The 2004 Moral Values exit poll, which was a very sloppily done poll, it was not done by the Gallup organization, was one that could not be verified, could not be checked by an election, and did steer the Democratic Party, political discourse, the media, to actually make that finding a social reality. And that's where I think we need to be a bit wary of some of the polls. Now, of course, we can't go back to an age, nor would we want to, I think, where we didn't have a kind of scientific read on what Americans believed. And perhaps the most significant change that's occurred since, I'd say, the 1960s has been that poll data that we are supplied with is much finer in its segmentation of the population. Part of the problem with earlier polls was that they segmented the population into majorities and minorities, for example, and therefore homogenized the population in really problematic ways.
Maybe
so
a
that
distorting
you couldn't
way.
See. That's right. So you wouldn't know, for instance, that those Super Bowl results had a difference if you asked by gender. So you could have George Gallup asking in the 1930s whether married women ought to take jobs during the Depression. And those results were not broken down by gender, by sex, in their broadcasting.
Right,
of course, they were in their formulation, but not in their broadcasting. So you get a false idea of how homogeneous, I think, the population is.
And who thinks what? You write at the same time about the surveyed culture that we've become, the kind of feedback loop at work here. And I want to look at that, but a lot of these, our fellow citizens, want to join us. Let me turn to them, if I may. In Nashville, Tennessee, Craig's on the line. Hi, Craig. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Two things. One is I've heard statisticians say, I can't quote the exact writer, but I've heard him say that, no, the numbers don't lie, but you can move them around and make them say whatever you want them to say. And I've experienced that. You know, the whole idea of a push poll. You know, almost any question is a push question, and objectivity is imaginary.
And what about our sense of ourselves? How we understand ourselves in this polled universe, Craig?
Well, I think that's a problem. I think all the way from the individual who ends up feeling tentative about their maybe not mainstream viewpoint because they think they feel they're outnumbered and their position will be unpopular, all the way to the presidential candidates who will not actually say what their plan is based on trying to cater to what they imagine people want to hear. I think that polls are more problematic than they are beneficial to the degree that they inhibit people actually making their own independent decision.
Craig, thanks for calling. Jack Beatty, what about it? I don't know what the final balance is, but what about the dynamic wherein our internal process of thinking things through gets influenced by this vast external exercise of the poll?
Well, I think Frank could speak to this. This bandwagon effect, I mean, does seem to me to be real. People get, you read that your candidate is behind and you lose heart. If you didn't know the candidate, and then perhaps you don't even vote. So that then becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. The reporting of the number discourages you. That lowers turnout, and it brings about what the number first documented, that the other guy was going to win. So I do think there are those pernicious effects to polling, and I don't know how pollers can correct for it, but I think that that is a deleterious effect, or it can be, of polling.
Frank, what's the long-term impact of being polled to a fare-thee-well?
I disagree with a lot of it. We're all better off knowing than not knowing who we are or where we stand. It's too bad. Science is with us. We can understand the average American's weight, the average American's height. We now understand where other Americans stand. We're better off rather than worse off knowing that. There's very little evidence that there is a bandwagon effect, and if there is, so what? If an American wants to take into account how his or her fellow Americans are thinking and feeling and making their own decision, that's a pretty good criteria. It's better than doing it randomly or based on reading one publication, I think. And as the caller said, the fact that politicians might tailor their policy prescriptions based on public opinion, in my opinion, is great. That's what an elected democracy is all about, although there is some argument philosophically about just how an elected representative is supposed to act in a representative democracy. I'm all in favor of politicians paying a lot closer attention to public opinion, and with 300-plus million Americans, we need polling to be able to do it.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief of the Gallup Poll, thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Sarah Igo, what about it? Frank puts out the average American every day, height, weight, you name it. Long run, is this good for us, staring at this statistical average American?
I think it can be. As Frank pointed out, I think it ought to be supplemented by other kinds of information, other kinds of perhaps more deeply contextualized kinds of information about Americans that might come from more sustained sorts of studies. You know, one thing that's quite interesting, thinking about this historically, is that this fear about the influence of polling figures really were with polls from their inception. In 1936, when George Gallup projects Franklin Roosevelt's to succeed in the 1936 election and is correct, automatically the halls of Congress begin buzzing with plans to legislate or ban or regulate polls because of the worry about the bandwagon effect.
Sarah Igo is with us. She is an assistant professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the new study of the origins of polling in America, The Averaged American. Jack Beatty's here. Here's a brand new report just out recently from the Pew Research Center on 18 to 25-year-olds. Boil all the numbers down, and it says if you're 18 to 25, you're tolerant, tech-savvy, idealistic, and liberal-leaning. Okay, right or wrong, does that describe you? Do you see yourself in the polls? Doug is calling from Chesapeake, Virginia. Hi, Doug. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How you doing?
Good.
I am an average white American with an average income, 2.3 kids. You know, I participate in society fully, and I've never been polled. I'm very skeptical of polls because I'm wondering, who are they asking?
You know, because nobody ever talked to you, and you're the archetypal American, huh?
I'm waiting for Frank to knock on my door with a clipboard in his hand.
Well, I mean, maybe you're the archetype, and maybe you're not, but it's a big country, and they do these kind of 1,000 people at a time. So, what, you think they're talking to, I don't know, do you think they've outsourced it to Mumbai?
Yeah, that's what I'm wondering.
Exactly. Sarah, what do you say to Doug, who sees himself as the archetype, never polled?
I'm so glad you said that. One of the things that most interested me in researching the origins and history of the polls was that this was the issue that most rankled Americans, that a technology that claimed to be democratic, it was picking up the common man's voice, didn't ask a lot of people what they thought. And in fact, if you go back to the early days of polling, you find all kinds of citizens writing to the pollsters begging to be interviewed or just giving their views even though they hadn't been asked as part of a scientific sample. And I think this goes to something that came up a little bit earlier, this sense that perhaps people's individuality is taken away by polls, that if they can be so predicted by a scientific sample, that somehow their sovereign individuality has been violated. Now, in terms of the numbers of people who are actually polled, even though it seems like we live in a culture where people are being asked questions all the time, of course, many people escape the phone call from the pollster. And don't get their voice officially counted. Now, there's supposed to be someone out there just like our caller, you know, who answered the questions as he would have. But lots of people will never be asked, and I think this is part of what makes people continue to be skeptical about the polls.
Let me take a call from Michelle in Norfolk, Virginia. Hi, Michelle, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes, that's exactly the point that I was calling to make, was that during the recent, you know, Senate elections, and here in Virginia, we unfortunately, you know, bore the brunt of that, I'm sure. But Stan Phillips was on TV saying that 40% of Americans disapproved of the Bush administration. Well, nobody asked me. And I would have certainly taken the call if I had gotten one. So although he didn't, you know, Gallup didn't put those words in his mouth, they provided him with the information to disuse as he saw fit. And maybe Gallup, and, you know, instead of being so smug and arrogant about the fact that they don't care what happens after the numbers are put out there, maybe they ought to be thinking that if someone quotes them incorrectly, maybe they ought to call them on it.
But what do you mean by smug and arrogant, Michelle? I'm sure Frank Newport would say, "Dear Michelle, we're working for you. We're polling so you can know what your fellow countrymen and women think."
I think they're maybe that's what it initially started out at, but I am entirely skeptical of polls, and I think that they serve more to gather in the sheep than they do to let people actually express their opinions.
Wow, there's still strong feeling on this polling front after all these decades of doing it. Michelle, thanks for calling. Let me get a call from Boston. Dane is on the line. Hi, Dane, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing today?
We're well.
Well, I was listening earlier, and you described 20-year-old males, white, tech-savvy, and liberal-leaning, and that's me to a T.
Okay, so are you in the 18 to 25-year-old range that the Pew Research Center surveyed?
Yes, I'm 20 years old, college student, love the technology.
So they got you, they pinpointed you exactly.
The more informed decision somebody can make, the better decision that will be. So I'm all for polls. I think they're a great asset to our society.
Because you think it really helps us know ourselves better. Dane, we got it. Thanks for calling. Jack, there's Dane, who heard himself perfectly targeted by that recent poll, and he's all for polls. He's affirmed.
Well, he's affirmed by them. And, you know, polls can correct cliches, unballasted cliches. After the 2000 election, David Brooks in the Atlantic Monthly compared two counties, one in Maryland and one in rural Pennsylvania, drove through them, wrote this picture of, you know, really cultural polarization, red America and blue America. And then an inquiring reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer traveled through the same county in Pennsylvania, and where David Brooks had said, you can't buy a meal for more than $20 in this county. Mm. This woman said, my gosh, I ate for $45 here. In other words, she corrected him on point after point. And, you know, this idea of cultural polarization, I'm looking at an article from the recent Journal of Economic Perspectives that has a whole, that's called Purple America, and that confirms in voluminous data, polling data, how grouped to the middle on moral and economic issues people are, regardless of their economic scale, regardless of where they live, regardless of their religion. There is less cultural polarization than there was, say, around the turn of the century. So yet the notion of cultural polarization continues, even though the polls and the not just the polls, but election surveys and social surveys indicate there, in fact, is a kind of moral consensus.
Jack, are you massaging the polls here?
I'm massaging the poll.
I want to bring one more voice into this conversation. Joining us from New York is Nate Persily, professor of law and political science at the University of Pennsylvania, author of the forthcoming Public Opinion and Constitutional Controversy. Nate Persily, wonderful to have you back. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me back.
Sarah has taken a long look at the origin of polling in America and how it shapes our sense of ourselves. You're looking particularly at the Constitution and politics. What's your sense of how it steers our self-understanding in our politics, polling?
Well, as Sarah points out, I mean, we are subjected to an enormous number of polls, and we can pretty much every day you can find a new poll that has been taken on various issues. In our book, we look at all those sort of moral values questions that you were speaking about before, whether it's abortion or desegregation, affirmative action, flag burning, school prayer, et cetera. And, you know, I think that what Sarah points out is correct, that we sort of have this infatuation with the what our neighbors are thinking on these issues. But I think what Frank Newport was saying is absolutely correct, which is that these polls are affecting public policy. We, in a sense, know who's ahead and who's behind based on these public opinion polls. But it does correct, I think, a lot of misinterpretation that people have about what the American people might otherwise be thinking. So we look at all types of questions. For instance, you know, take abortion, for example, which is one of the most polled issues. You know, you find that a majority of Americans are want the Supreme Court to uphold Roe versus Wade, but at the same time, most Americans are in favor of certain types of restrictions on the right of an abortion, and all those I think are very interesting, both the political debate as well as in some cases the legal debate.
But what about the impact of generation after generation turning over just click 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 of polls? You know, again and again and again. At some point, do we become prisoners of polls, Nate Persily? Do they herd the country towards some kind of artificial or ossified mean, because we are at some level sort of herd instinct creatures?
I don't know. I mean, I don't really see that in the data. I mean, you know, people are divided, as we can see in various elections and in their opinions on social and moral issues, let alone, you know, perceptions of the economy, the war, et cetera. So the fact that there's extensive division out there seems to suggest that, you know, repeated polling is not pushing us toward 100% of American people believing in a particular way.
Sarah Igo, you write about the surveyed culture. What's the import of living in, after all these decades now, the thoroughly surveyed culture? How does it manifest itself in the way we think, the way we understand ourselves?
Well, I think surveys have changed along with the country itself in some really important ways, so that the main things that I was concerned with in my book were really mid-century iconic images of Americans coming out of the polls. And I don't think that's what comes out of the polls today, or any other kinds of surveys for that matter, for a number of reasons, pollsters, along with the society they live in, are much more interested in questions of segmentation and fragmentation, and, you know, how black voters versus white voters or Hispanic voters approach issues.
It's not making an artificial archetype out there, you say?
That's right. I mean, I think there are still impulses in the survey profession, and certainly in the public, to find still a kind of normative Americanness. And I think, of course, social scientific tools are always simplifying rather than making social life more complex. That's part of their job. And so that the fact that we see percentages still of, you know, majorities and minorities out of set categories of questions is something that simplifies our social life and isn't always necessarily helpful. Polls have led to some new kinds of icons and stereotypes, like the soccer mom or the security mom or Joe Sixpack or what have you, that are not, I think, particularly insightful or interesting necessarily characters to add to our national life. That said, I do think the kind of constant questioning and the constant ability to read poll results probably does make many people more well-informed and helps them sharpen their views, not necessarily change them, but helps them to understand where they might fit into a larger statistical public. And I certainly don't think all of that is bad. What I do think is perhaps worrisome about a surveyed culture is the fact that we don't think about how influential these polls are on a day-to-day basis. There's so many of them, and when we agree with them, we certainly don't challenge them. And as they've become more ubiquitous, they've become more invisible, and therefore we don't stop and think about what might be the influence of all these numbers or what questions aren't being asked, what kinds of things are absent from our political discourse because we make this recourse to numbers and to pollsters' power in a way to define what is or is not a subject of national prominence.
To define who we are and what we're thinking about, whether locked in the box or out of it. Let's take a call from Diana in Somerville, Massachusetts. Hi, Diana. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks. Hi. So my point is polls always crack me up a little because I find when I agree with what the poll says, then I feel affirmed. And then there are many times when I don't agree with what the poll says, and no one single person that I know agrees with what the poll says. For instance, when Bush's approval ratings were really high, I thought, am I that marginalized? I don't know anybody that approves of what he's doing. And so at those times, I find myself extremely skeptical of polls. But then, of course, when they agree with me, I'm like, yeah, that's right.
Right. Cheer when they're with you and toss it out the window when it's not. Diana, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Amston, Connecticut. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah. My question regards how do we assure a sample population with the amount of ways we can reach people now? Cell phones, for instance. I know myself, I have a landline for specifically using for my internet. How do you assure, I think it was easier back when you could just use a telephone. How are you doing that these days?
That's a good question. When everybody was linked up on one Ma Bell network, you knew what was out there. Sarah, what about now when people are off on cell phones and internet phones, Skype, and all the rest? Will we be able to, as technologies fracture, continue to have persuasive, statistically credible polls?
Well, this is something that survey researchers are, of course, very, very concerned about. But even before the internet and before cell phones came on the scene, response rates were declining to most kinds of surveys. In fact, some survey historians date this to 1952. That's when response rates started to fall. So they actually precede some of these technologies and may speak to the fact that while polls and surveys were novelties in the 30s and 40s, they've become more of an annoyance to many people. They've also been conflated with all kinds of other marketing surveys and intrusions into people's homes and dinner hours. And I think this is something that researchers are going to have to find. They're trying to find solutions to figure out how to get representative samples when perhaps a good portion of the population doesn't want to talk to them anymore.
Mm. Nate, personally,
can I jump in here?
Yes, please.
This is Nate. Let me say two things about that, which I think this is a very important point, and it speaks a little bit to the rise of the internet and how that's going to affect polling. We're now at a stage, I think it's fair to say, where at least good internet polls done by some very sophisticated firms are about as bad as phone polls. Okay, they're about as bad and about as good.
Okay. Right.
Because what happens, as the caller and as Sarah was suggesting, that it's not just people who are turning down the interviews, but it's also the bias in the phone. You know, the people who have phones or have landlines who are going to be called by the pollsters. Now,
right.
they try to correct for those things, and they do as good a job as they can. But some of these firms that do these internet polls, not only do they use computers, but they also actually give web TV to the population that doesn't have access to a computer. And so they try to get as representative a sample as they can and then repeatedly poll them with questions through those electronic media. Those are cheaper polls, and in some way, I mean, at least with the presidential election and some of the other polls that they've done, have proven to be about as reliable as the phone polls.
Does that mean we're headed into even a greater ubiquity of polling? Will the web eventually have us polled at every nanosecond of every day?
Some people, sure. I mean, but there are good, as with all these methods, there are good polls and there are bad polls, right? So that if you, and we've all been subjected to those links that say, Are you in favor of impeaching the president or something like that? Click here. All right. Now, those aren't the kinds of polls that are going to be terribly informative. It's the ones that are done by some of the more sophisticated firms that are trying to get representative samples. And one of the advantages of some of these internet polls is that once you have the sampled population, you don't have to repeatedly ask them, for example, what their race and gender is. You already have
you know.
Yeah.
Jack, off we go. Technology may, who knows, one day we could be polled, with every other breath about what we thought about everything. In a democracy, is this the natural way or is this, do you worry about it?
Well, Sarah leaves the possibility, of neuropolling.
Right. Don't even ask. Just know.
That's right, that they're going to have somehow, electrodes will pick up what we're really feeling about things. And, they won't, the whole issue of are you lying will be got round by, well, we've got your physiology, therefore we know what you're going to do. That is a little scary.
Looks like it's going to be with us for a long, long time and maybe deeper than ever. Sarah Igoe's new book is The Averaged American. Sarah, thank you for being with us this hour.
Oh, I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great to have you. And Nate Persily, also at University of Pennsylvania, with Public Opinion and Constitutional Controversy coming out. Nate, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Jack, good to have you. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.